eyes someday comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City. Job and tried to put my money away, but I got debts that no honest man can pay. So I drew what I had from the Central Trust, and I bought us two tickets on that close city bus. Baby, everything dies, baby, that's a bet.
Hi there, folks. This is Nick Solomon of the Beverage Bride, just having flirt dance in Kerry G. Take out the picture, watch it. Anyhow, you're listening to 19.7 FM, WGXB, Acre. And usually we're clear. Hooray. Have fun.
That's a fact. But maybe everything that dies someday comes back.
You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org. WGXC is made possible by the generous support of Stewart's Summer Talk Festival.
I've been looking for a job, but it's hard to find. Down here it's just winners and losers, and don't get caught on the wrong side of that line. Well, I'm tired of coming out on.
Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I can see you're disappointed by the way you look at me, and I'm sorry that I'm not the woman you thought I'd be. Yes, I've made my mistakes, but listen and understand. Mistakes are no worse than yours just because I'm a woman. So when you look at me, don't feel sorry for yourself. Just think of all the shame you might have brought somebody else. Tell you this, then we'll both know where we stand. My mistakes are no worse than yours just because I'm a woman. Now a man will take a good girl her reputation. But when he wants to marry, well, that's a different situation. He'll just walk off and leave her to do the best she can. While he looks for an angel to wear his wedding band. Now I know that I'm no angel, if that's what you thought you'd found. I was just the victim of a man that let me down. Yes, I've made my mistakes, but listen and understand, my mistakes are no worse than yours, just because I'm a woman. No, my mistakes are no worse than yours, just because I'm a woman.
This is not what America wants. And in a democracy on this issue, the Supreme Court does not get the last word. The people do. And we are going to fight back. We've got tools. We're going to use them. And in November, we're going to make sure that we elect enough people who believe in that democracy that we can pass Roe versus Wade and make it the law of the land again. Only this time we'll do it by statute and enforce it.
So as Senator Durbin mentioned, we traveled here today. In fact, they both joined me along with the Secretary on Air Force Two. And we traveled here from D.C. today to talk with you about maternal health, which should be one of our highest priorities as a nation. And I had planned to speak about our strategy for improving care for pregnant women and mothers across our country. And as you know, on the way here, however, we learned that the United States Supreme Court had rendered its decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. Here's what that decision means. For nearly 50 years, we have talked about what Roe v. Wade protects. Today, as of right now, as of this minute, we can only talk about what Roe v. Wade protected. Past tense. This is a healthcare crisis. Because understand, millions of women in America will go to bed tonight without access to the healthcare and reproductive care that they had this morning. Without access to the same healthcare or reproductive healthcare that their mothers and grandmothers had for 50 years. This is the first time in the history of our nation that a constitutional right has been taken from the people of America. And what is that right? Some might ask. It's the right to privacy. Think about it. As the right for each person to make intimate decisions about heart and home. Decisions about the right to start a family, including contraception, such as IUDs, the morning after pill. Decisions about whether to have a child, including, as Senator Durbin mentioned, through in vitro fertilization. Decisions to marry the person you love. Obergefell, the Hodges, loving versus Virginia. This opinion also says, when you read it, that abortion is not deeply rooted in our nation's history. They offer that, in the opinion, as a foundation for the decision they render today. In holding that it is not deeply rooted in our history, today's decision on that theory, then, calls into question other rights that we thought were settled, such as the right to use birth control, the right to same-sex marriage, the right to interracial marriage. The great aspiration of our nation has been to expand freedom. But the expansion of freedom clearly is not inevitable. It is not something that just happens. Not unless we defend our most fundamental principles. Not unless we elect leaders who stand up for those principles. The strength of our nation has always been that we move forward. Today, I invite all people to stand together in defense of one of the most fundamental ideals and principles that for generations, for centuries, I believe, we have held dear, which is that fundamental principle about the importance of liberty. To stand for liberty, to stand for freedom, to stand for self-determination, and for the right to privacy. You have the power to elect leaders who will defend and protect your rights. And as the President said earlier today, with your vote, you can act. And you have the final word. So this is not over. God bless you, and God bless America.
The very future of reproductive justice is at stake, the future of affirmative action and other strategies designed to restructure the institutions of this country. We know that pivotal political moments, and I'm speaking of political in the larger sense of the word, having to do with power, have been marked by Supreme Court decisions. But of course, the decisions are not themselves the explanation for change. Rather, the courts often reflect the changes that have occurred as a result of social movements. And so I think that these current hearings have a great deal to do with what unfolds both within the judicial realm, but also within the realm of struggles for justice.
So that's really interesting, of course, because right now there is just so much on the streets that is pointing in the direction of reform, demanding reform. Shelby versus Holder was the Supreme Court rolling back so much of the civil rights movement, and that was in 2013, the Civil Rights Act, rather. And now we have Black Lives Matter out on the streets and making their demands. What do you think of both the longevity and the impact of this movement on the streets compared to what you all went through in the 60s and the effect of a very conservative court, if she is appointed, 6-3 conservative to liberal, on civil rights?
Well, of course, already as a result of the current administration, we've experienced attacks on the court system, the federal, there have been efforts to create a court system that is designed to serve as a bulwark for conservatives. And I think, certainly if she is confirmed, we will have to bear the consequences, and they will be devastating. They will absolutely be devastating. At the same time, I think it's important to point out that the social movements whose surges we are witnessing now have very long histories. The movement against racism goes back for many, many centuries.
Yes, we believe in freedom, and not arrest. You're listening to WGXC, ACRA, Radio for Open Ears. I'm Alana, your host. This is There, There, on the fourth Sunday of every month from 7 to 8 p.m. Thanks for tuning in on this sort of steamy Sunday evening. That was an iconic performance by Sweet Honey in the Rock, Ella's song. That particular one was in 2008. Before that, we heard a couple clips from the news. One was with Angela Davis on Amanpour and Company back in 2020, as the Amy Coney Barrett hearings were going on. We also heard a clip with our VP, Kamala Harris, on C-SPAN. She was, that was just a couple days ago. She was speaking to a group in Illinois, the 14th Congressional District at the YMCA of Plainfield, Illinois. And before that, a brief clip of Elizabeth Warren on CNN. And we started off today with Dolly, Just Because I'm a Woman. I'm Alana, your host. Be here till 8. Coming up next, a little history talk with Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman. Excerpts from a podcast Now and Then from last September.
Basically, in colonial and early America, abortion in generally, the legal status of it varied on the type of colony, but the key point that mattered when people were considering when abortion should be allowed or not allowed was this idea of quickening, which means the first perception of fetal movement by the pregnant woman. This is, again, part of a long trend of trying to sort of name the moment when it matters, that in a pregnancy, oh, it's when the woman can perceive movement. Oh, no, it has to do with the heartbeat. This is a longstanding question, too. But in early America, typically this quickening, as it was perceived at the time, tended to happen at the midpoint of a pregnancy, around the fourth or early in the fifth month. After that point, so after quickening, an abortion was basically considered to be a form of manslaughter. Before that point, it was considered to be allowable, but as is so often the case in American history, throughout American history, but in this period as well, much of what was happening in the realm of abortion was private, women sort of helping each other, midwives actually coming forward with a variety of different herbs and things that women could take if they wanted to induce an abortion. There are a variety of different herbs, which I just need to say because they're so wonderful sounding as words. Black draft, tansy tea, oil of cedar, ergo of rye, mallow, and motherwort, among the many things that you could take in early America, herbs that were referred to at the time as, quote, taking the trade, meaning using these substances to induce an abortion. And in advance of quickening, they were legal. Generally speaking, they were socially acceptable. Now, it's worth noting that different colonies that were colonized by different countries had different understandings and assumptions about abortion. So in British colonies, abortions were generally legal if they were performed before quickening. French colonies, abortions were performed despite the fact that they were considered to be illegal. In Spanish and Portuguese colonies, abortion was illegal. So even at the time, it varied. But really, from the 18th century until the mid-19th century, abortion was kind of viewed as socially unacceptable, but allowable. It happened. It wasn't advertised. It was sort of veiled hints were made about it in advertisements for substances so that women could make use of them, if they wanted to induce an abortion, so that people weren't saying, here, buy this, and you can have an abortion. And yet the message was clear. A great example of that is an ad that I found in poking around this last week from a newspaper in 1810. Actually, this one happens to be in Maine. And it was advertising a patent medicine called Dr. Rolfe's Aromatic Female Pills. And the description of the pills concluded with the warning that the pills were, quote, conducive to the health of married women. And then the next three words were underlined. Unless when pregnant, at which time they must not be taken, as they would most certainly produce miscarriage. this was a substance that was, although not being officially advertised that way, clearly intended to be something that women could take if they wanted to produce a miscarriage.
And I think it's also important to note here that the concept of quickening is, of course, self-reported. And it's quite late, and it can be quite late in a pregnancy. And that there is this sense, to me anyway, that there's an awful lot of sort of a women's world regulation of reproduction in the 19th century, at least, which is my period, that the statistics and sort of saying, well, is it acceptable or not? Well, a lot of what's going on is simply never captured in the newspapers because women are not writing necessarily in columns what they're doing.
No, some of where you see that, actually. I mean, not only is it a women's world as far as women helping women do this, but midwives are often the people involved in this. So it's women helping women, and women themselves are engaged in this process. It really is women sort of as a team helping each other through this kind of a moment.
But the relationship between producing children and what that says about society is firmly ingrained by the middle of the 19th century in America. And in the middle of the 19th century, it becomes very tangled with what America is going to become and who has control over that reproduction. And nothing really says that more than the way Southern white enslavers thought about the women they enslaved and their relationship to children. They believe that somehow the Black enslaved women on their plantations have some secret in which they are destroying the babies they're carrying, in part because those babies, of course, are valuable, like monetarily valuable to the enslavers. And so when women who are undernourished, overworked, living in terrible conditions, go ahead and miscarry children, rather than looking at the entire situation, the enslavers often just assume that they are, in fact, aborting their children. And of course, some of them almost certainly are. But the point I'm trying to make here is that there is this sort of mystery about what women do with babies. As I think I said earlier, it's no mystery that when colonial Americans go after people they consider to be witches, they tend to start with women who are around that sort of mystery of birth. And for Black women, enslaved Black women in the mid-19th century American South, that translates to somehow they are deliberately undermining their enslavers by killing their own children.
And so part of what we're looking at, even at this early point, it has to do with control, right? We're talking about the control of people enslaving others. We're talking about in the mid and sort of late 19th century, the control of male doctors trying to take control of this process away from midwives who really were in control of this before. The American Medical Association's crusade against abortion was partly a professional move to establish the supremacy of quote unquote regular doctors over midwives. More broadly, anti-abortion sentiment at that point, in addition to being a kind of professional move, was also connected to nativism, to anti-Catholicism, and as Heather has already said, to anti-feminism. In the late 19th century, immigration, particularly by Catholics and non-whites, was increasing, while birth rates among white native-born Protestants was declining. And so all of this is happening at the same time, so that you get people out and out saying, like, a doctor and anti-abortion leader, Horatio Storer, saying in 1868, "Will the West be filled by our own children or by those of aliens? This is a question our women must answer. Upon their loins depends the future destiny of the nation." That is quite a quote. Again, it's an issue of control in a whole variety of different ways bundled together.
One of the reasons we get the rise of the American Medical Association is to take away from women the power to have this control over life and death, as it were, to go ahead and change the outcome of births, which in turn changes the outcome of society. So abortion and the issue of controlling reproduction becomes literally about what it means to have a country. And it's a telescoping of the individual decisions of women with the larger interests of society and comes down to control of those women, control over these incredibly intimate decisions of these women. And just to pop back for a moment to enslaved women, in addition to the power struggle over, you know, you are enslaved by me, therefore you must bear children, which bring a value to me, the human side of that always jumps out to me, that medical expertise now tells us that, you know, obviously, if your body is stressed, if you're not eating right, all of those things, that you're going not to be able to have a successful pregnancy, that women who are under such extraordinary stresses already are then punished for the fact their body can't sustain a pregnancy. So the issue of abortion, and even greater later on, the issue of sudden infant death syndrome, which is, it's a problem in the 19th century anyway, but it's certainly a problem on plantations, becomes blamed on Black women for, and this is in quotations, for smothering their children. We now know that sudden infant death syndrome in that era was correlated with malnutrition and with the conditions of the mother and the conditions in which that child lived. And the fact that these women are getting blamed for the physical conditions in which they are enslaved, I just, to me, even saying that, I can feel the walls closing in on my brain. There is no way to turn that you aren't at fault for things that are way beyond your control. And it's being imposed on you, of course, by your enslaver and by the society that supports that. And that, for me, the issue of abortion and sudden infant death syndrome around enslaved Black women, to me, that encapsulates the system of enslavement really more than any other aspect of that incredibly brutal system.
And it shows a trend in thinking about and dealing with abortion, whether you're talking about enslaved populations or other populations. And in a way, you and I, Heather, have already been doing this by talking about heartbeat laws and quickening. There's a way in which, for lack of better words, maybe I'll say the establishment, but there's a way in which abortion conversations happen in which, just as you've just suggested, the personal component of it is stripped away and it becomes kind of an abstract conversation about, in your case, you're suggesting people who are enslaving people and they're worried about the value of the people who they own or they claim to own and their children. It becomes a question of when does life start or the medical profession. It becomes part of all of these more abstract questions when what we're really looking at, and you just put it wonderfully by talking about the walls closing in, it's something that's profoundly personal. And that often is not included in discussion of abortion by those trying to enforce that kind of control.
Well, and especially for Black enslaved women, I think that issue really highlights the mindset of, and I put this in air quotes here, I own you, therefore I own the process of your reproduction. And of course, the toll on female bodies from having children is extraordinary. And that moment, I think, makes that link really starkly clear. So let's move forward then from this sort of amorphous, well, yeah, technically we don't think that abortion is a great idea, but we're going to rely on women to report when they're quickening, and we're going to go ahead and make sure that they don't have obstructions that are slowing down their menstrual cycles, blockages. The healthcare issue of abortion in the late 19th century, because that moment is an important one. It brings politics into this discussion in a way that it really hadn't been before. So the interesting period for the criminalization of abortion in America, to my mind, is the 1870s. Of course, everything is interesting in the 1870s, as far as I'm concerned. But
not that you're biased at all.
That's right. So while people tend to focus on Anthony Comstock, who managed to get through the Comstock Law in March of 1873 to make it a misdemeanor to sell or advertise any what they called obscene matter by mail or any article or thing designed or intended for the prevention of conception or procuring of abortion, a concept that was tied into the nativism that you talk about, the idea that they want white people to have babies, but also tied into the idea of stopping these women from going ahead and taking control of reproduction in America. What is really interesting to me about the 1870s is the politics of abortion, because it's the 1870s that give us abortion really as a political issue. And it's certainly tied into anti-immigrant sentiments. It's certainly tied into the concerns about growing power of women, but it's also tied into party politics. Because what happens is by the 1870s, there is so much money in advertising for abortion that it can make or break a newspaper. And in New York, New York City, which is vital for the control of the White House, because if you control New York City, you essentially control New York. And New York has, I think it's off the top of my head, 35 or 36 electoral votes, which is a lot more than anybody else. It comes down to whether or not you can go ahead and support a newspaper based on the amount of advertising you can get. Well, the issue in New York City is that the New York City police are connected to Tammany Hall, which is a Democratic organization. So they go ahead and they let the Democratic papers take advertising from people who perform abortions, but they don't let the Republican newspapers do that. So the Republican newspapers in 1871 pitch a conniption fit, and they run, the New York Times runs this major story on what they call abortionists, and it's this totally lurid, terrible story about, and I shouldn't actually be as graphic as the newspaper story is, but it is very graphic, let's just put it that way, about what they found in a basement in New York. It's the sensational kind of story of the time.
I was going to say, it's of that moment, that sort of story is highly popular on any number of issues.
Lots of blood in any story like that. And actually, there's a lot of stories earlier on about self-induced abortions that are also very formulaic, very stock, and very, I mean, they're always an immigrant girl. She's always on a back stairs. She's always on the on a set of stairs in a back alley, things like that. What happens then is they go ahead and they have this newspaper crusade to go ahead and essentially to undercut the ability of people who perform abortions to take out ads in the Democratic newspapers. Because what they're really saying is, you know, the Democratic police officers are in on this. They're permitting this to happen. And we must stop this practice. And their concern is really not the issue of abortion. And their concern is really not the women who they claim are being butchered in these basement facilities. Their concern is really that if the Democratic newspapers continue to be able to support themselves by running these advertisements, the Republicans are going to be hurting in the upcoming elections. So there is this moment right here in 1871 in which politics meets the issue of abortion in a really powerful way. And after that, the anti-abortion movement takes off.
Let me add in, too, though, what you just pointed out, Heather, with politics and the press. It's that combination. So it becomes politicized, as you're saying, but it also gets bound up with the partisan press in a way that has a real power as well in this time period.
And so increasingly after the 1870s, you get a few before that in the 1860s, but after the 1870s, you're going to get one state law after another that goes ahead and restricts the right to abortion. About 100 years later, by about 1960, the inability of women to obtain safe legal abortions means that there are between 200,000 and 1.2 million illegal abortions in America a year, which is a public health crisis, especially among poorer women who can't afford the workarounds that wealthier women could do, going, for example, to a different country to get an abortion. So it actually, in the 1960s, becomes a crusade on the part of doctors, not on the part of women who are in the nascent civil rights movement, but of doctors to go ahead and decriminalize abortion and make it a decision between themselves and their patients so that they can simply stop the death rate that they're seeing around them. And actually, the women's rights movement comes into this argument quite late, relatively. In 1969, Betty Friedan is actually at, who's a leader of the feminist movement, is actually at a medical abortion meeting. And she says, and I quote, "My only claim to be here is our belated recognition, if you will, that there is no freedom, no equality, no full human dignity and personhood possible for women until we assert and demand the control over our own bodies, over our own reproductive processes." And then she goes on to say, "Women are denigrated in this country because women are not deciding the conditions of their own society and their own lives. Women are not taken seriously as people. Women are not seen seriously as people. So this is the new name of the game on the question of abortion, that women's voices are heard." So the doctors started, and then the feminist movement takes it up. So by 1972, About 64% of Americans agreed that abortion was an issue between a woman and her doctor. 68% of Republicans said that. They had always been on the fans of family planning. And 59% of Democrats, who had more Catholics among them, agreed with that as well. And interestingly enough, while people focus on the 1973 Roe versus Wade decision to talk about how this sparks a backlash, there's this phenomenal article that I found a real game changer by Linda Greenhouse and Reva Siegel, who actually points out that the backlash, if you will, it's actually a front lash against Roe versus Wade, starts before the 1972 election, to pick up this thread of politics. It starts before the 72 election when, if you remember, Richard Nixon was in serious crap after May 1970, when he's got to deal with fallout from the Kent State shooting. And at that point, he really begins to polarize the country quite deliberately. Spiro Agnew calls it positive polarization. And his advisor, Pat Buchanan, who had been on the Goldwater team back in the 1960s, said that the way to go ahead and guarantee re-election in 1972 was to go ahead and pick up Catholic Democrats, because the Catholics who were beginning to waver on the Democratic Party as it was doing its thing in the 1960s, and the Catholics, Buchanan thought, could be picked up. Buchanan himself was a Catholic, and he urged Nixon to reach for the Catholic Democrats. So actually, in 1970, Nixon had gone ahead and he had directed U.S. military hospitals, and there are tons of them all over the country, especially in the South, to perform abortions regardless of state law. But then in 1971, he changes his course in order to split the Democrats and attract them, the traditional Democrats, to the Republican Party. And he uses Catholic language to do that. He cites his personal belief, and he's not a Catholic himself, of course, in the sanctity of human life, including the life of the yet unborn. And even though he and McGovern had very similar positions in the 1972 election, the Republicans dubbed the Democratic nominee as the candidate of acid, amnesty, and abortion.
Triple and A.
The triple A, yes. And what's interesting about that is when Phyllis Schlafly, who is a Republican activist at the time, makes her first statement about abortion in 1972, this is what she said. And I'm always excited about this, because when we talk about abortion, because, of course, now the language of abortion and political opposition to abortion is the language of protecting the unborn. But that's new. Listen to what Phyllis Schlafly said in 72. She said, women's lib, that is women's liberation movement, women's lib is a total assault on the role of the American woman as wife and mother, and on the family as the basic unit of society. Women's libbers are trying to make wives and mothers unhappy with their career, make them feel that they are second-class citizens and abject slaves. Women's libbers are promoting free sex instead of the slavery of marriage. They are promoting federal daycare centers for babies instead of homes. They are promoting abortions instead of families. And that, of course, becomes the root of this, what is going to become the pro-life movement, the idea that actually abortion is about the denigration of the traditional roles of wives and mothers. And in fact, in 1984, a sociologist actually did the research and discovered that people who were pro-life activists believed that women who were advocating for reproductive choice were denigrating the roles of wife and mother rather than going ahead and valuing those roles. So by the time you get to Rush Limbaugh, when he's talking about feminazis and saying that, and I quote, the most important thing in life is ensuring that as many abortions as possible occur, the idea of abortion has become a stand-in for we are rejecting the traditional roles of American women.
So that kind of extreme language and extreme claims on the part of people like Rush Limbaugh brings us, in a sense, back to something that we were beginning to talk about at the beginning of the show, and which we've talked about before, which has to do with intimidation. In this case, anti-abortion violence. So, for example, on May 31st, 2009, Wichita Dr. George Tiller was shot and killed while serving as an usher at his church. The assailant, who is an anti-abortion extremist named Scott Roeder, claimed he felt forced to act to save the lives of unborn children. Tiller ultimately made himself the nation's preeminent abortion practitioner, and he advertised his services. He drew women to Wichita from all over with his willingness to perform late-term abortions. He had, before being killed, been shot once before by a different anti-abortion activist who compared abortion providers to Hitler and said that she believed that justifiable force was necessary to stop abortions. I'll actually add to that, that idea of it's murder and so murder is justified to stop it as a trope that's used very often by some anti-abortion activists. Operation Rescue, which is founded in just a few years before that point, 1986, by Randall Terry. Their slogan was, quote, "If you believe abortion is murder, act like it's murder." So we're talking about violence and murder being justified as a way to protest abortion and a woman's right of choice. After Tiller is killed by that anti-abortion activist, Bill O'Reilly, who's a Fox News Channel host, comes under fire from a lot of his earlier criticism of Tiller. He called him, quote, "Tiller the baby killer" for performing late-term abortions and repeatedly said that Tiller had, quote, "blood on his hands." Within 9 hours of Dr. Tiller's death, Salon Magazine had cataloged references to Tiller on 29 episodes of The O'Reilly Factor from 2005 to 2009. So again, there's a campaign. Before we were talking about newspapers, now we're talking about television, but still a campaign of extreme charges that's encouraging extreme reactions in people on the question of abortion. Right. I mean, and think fundamentally about the question of rights. When I have thought about the question of abortion before, and when I have taught, not abortion, but about rights to my students in like my American Revolution course, one of the things that I teach them about rights is that rights are important, not necessarily only because you are planning to insist on them at a given point, but that if you don't protect them, you lose them. I talk about the American Revolution as a period when people perceived rights being violated and that that violation mattered, that violation could lead to other things. And so that it isn't necessarily that you need to feel that something immediate and personal to you at a given moment is being violated for you to get upset. The broader level of what's going on here and what you, Heather, keep referring to is that there are fundamental rights that are being attacked in fundamentally illegal ways. And those rights matter whether or not I ever chose to, and I didn't choose to have children and thus need an abortion. The idea that it is my fundamental constitutional right to make that kind of a choice, well, that matters enormously to me because of the very sorts of things you're talking about, Heather. The many other rights that are wrapped up in that and that become threatened when this issue is discussed and attacked in this way.
And that, I think, is, of course, as historians, that's exactly what we see, the incursion on constitutional rights. And it worries me when we discuss SB 8, for example, or when we talk about the issue of abortion, that it's a wedge to go ahead and remove a whole lot more constitutional rights, and that people won't necessarily see that because they get tangled into the very important individual and emotional reactions to the issue of childbearing, of women's power, of children, of what our society should look like, all those hot button emotional issues that are ways to get around the larger, incredibly important issue for our democracy of the protection of our constitutional rights.
Right. They rouse emotions. And in doing that, and in very deliberately doing that, the fundamental constitutional question of rights gets veiled.
I will wait in the morning if you call, and I'll stand beside you long as I can. The evening of your sun, but I won't the heat of your day. And I'll drink from the sweat of your brow. I will walk to the tune of your song, but I won't crumble with you if you fall. Come walk with me and hold to touch me, let me know I'm here by myself. Stretch my night dreams into my day. Stop short of falling apart if I go down. I'm waking if you call, and I'll stand beside you long as I can. I will hold back the evening of your sun, but I
that was Bernice Johnson Reagan from the album, I believe it's Give Your Hands to Struggle. That was from 1975, Folkways recording. And this is WGXC ACRA, Radio for Open Ears. I'm Alana, your host. This has been There, There. We're on the fourth Sunday of every month. That's the Royal We. 7 to 8 p.m. You can hear shows in the archive at WGXC.org. If you're a fan of free-form community programming, you can support us by going to wgxc.org/donate. And we're also on the air in Greene and Columbia counties at 90.7 FM. We've got a few minutes left. Next track will be a little Pete Seeger with, let's see, who is she? The Young Woman Who Swallowed a Lie. Thanks for listening.
There was a young woman who swallowed a lie. I don't know why she swallowed the lie. Perhaps she'll die. There was a young woman who swallowed a rule, lived to serve men, she learned it at school. She swallowed the rule to prop up a lie, but I don't know why she swallowed the lie. Perhaps she'll die. There was a young woman who swallowed some fluff, lipstick and candy and powder and puff. She swallowed the fluff to follow the rule, lived to serve men, she learned it at school. She swallowed the rule to prop up the lie, but I don't know why she swallowed the lie. Perhaps she'll die. There was a young woman who swallowed a line. I like 'em dumb, baby, you suit me fine. She swallowed the line to follow the fluff. She swallowed the fluff to follow the rule. Lived to serve men, she learned it at school. She swallowed the rule to prop up the lie. But I don't know why she swallowed the lie. Perhaps she'll die. There was a young woman who swallowed a pill. Might have said no, but she hadn't the will. She swallowed the pill to follow the line, swallowed the line to follow the fluff, swallowed the fluff to follow the rule, lived to serve men, she learned it at school. She swallowed the rule to prop up the lie, but I don't know why she swallowed the lie. Perhaps she'll die. There was a young woman who swallowed a ring. Looked like a princess and felt like a thing. She swallowed the ring to make up for the pill. She swallowed the pill to follow the line. Swallowed the line to follow the fluff. Swallowed the fluff to follow the rule. Lived to serve men, she learned it at school. She swallowed the rule to prop up the lie. But I don't know why she swallowed the lie. Perhaps she.
Family leave, universal pre-K, tax credits aimed at helping families, medical assistance, other types of assistance. So it's not just about, okay, we don't want abortions. It's also about how do you care for that child? What do you make of where that leads us in the overall conversation?
Well, the reason why it's not a coherent system of thought or even a coherent is because it's not about what they say it's about. Fundamental choice around birth wouldn't be so stark for people. And you would have all sorts of carve-outs for various types of circumstances that are just what they say it's about. Fundamentally, the entire issue of bodily autonomy right now is very much tied into the Christian nationalist vision of America. We know that in 1972, even amongst Southern Baptists, the issue of abortion was not controversial. Roe v. Wade was not controversial. It became controversial in the wake of demographic changes in our country, other types of changes that people thought were abhorrent. And so the forces that were opposed to a desegregating America, that were opposed to an America in which women were asserting their rights and values, and to the growing power of LGBTQ people, all united behind this particular issue as the phalanx, as the tip of the spear in a Christian nationalist vision. So it's incoherent because it's not about what they say it's supposed to be about. Because if it were, we'd have a radically different America where the choice around birth wouldn't be so stark for people, and you would have all sorts of carve-outs for various types of circumstances that are just humane. But you don't, because this isn't about what they say it's about. It's about a political agenda that is radical at its core, and it's had success in a way that I think has stunned people and has ripped the curtain and allowed people to see it for what it is.
De algas y estrellas, considera los reinos que te esperan, sueña todos los sueños, florece de la tierra y en busca de futuros, fertiliza canciones, corona las palmeras.